Welcome to the first ever edition of Series 1 of the Grace in Common podcast. This is a podcast that is essentially an extended conversation between four friends. We come from four different countries on three continents. My name is James Eglinton, and I teach theology at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland. I'm joined by Grace Sutanto from Indonesia, but who teaches theology at Reformed Theological Seminary in DC in the States. Corey Brooke, who is from the States, but who is a pastor in Edinburgh here in Scotland, where I am. And Marinus de Jong, who is Dutch and who is a pastor in Amsterdam in the Netherlands. So this podcast, in essence, is us trying to make public conversations that have been going on between us for years and years now. We're four friends who come from these different places, but we have a lot in common in terms of shared theological interests, shared ways of thinking that seem to work their way out in our own lives and in our own contexts in ways that are really fascinating and enriching. So there's so much that we have in common in the first place, across our different contexts, and our hope is to share that with you, the listener. So the purpose of our podcast, I guess, today is to start fleshing out some of the theological distinctives that we have in common, and that inform our thinking and our lives as Christians across these different countries and continents. And that's the Neo-Calvinist tradition. So this is a theological tradition that we're all deeply influenced by in different ways, but we've come to it from quite different angles. So we thought that today, our first conversation would be to talk a little bit about what Neo-Calvinism is in the first place, and yeah, our own stories with Neo-Calvinism. I could begin by talking a little bit about my own background, which is, so I come from Scotland. I grew up in a Presbyterian denomination. As a teenager, I had a lot of questions about thinking in a Christian way about the world in which I live. So I grew up in a secularizing cultural context, and I grew up in a kind of evangelical church setting that was great at articulating what the church is, but it left a lot unanswered in terms of the world in which the church exists, or the culture that hosted us as a church, as a group of Christians. So I had questions around how do you participate in, for example, art that's produced by non-Christians, or what do you make of things like technology that's produced by non-Christians? There are all these things that we engage with every day, but I was looking for some kind of rationale for how all of that worked. And I didn't find out a lot of answers to those questions in my own Scottish tradition, but then I discovered this idea called Common Grace. So that's kind of a link to the title of our podcast, which is a play on that. And for me, I don't know what it was like for you guys, but this for me was a very first entry point into this Neo-Calvinist tradition. And it's an idea that God gives good gifts to people all across the world, and it gives those gifts regardless of whether the people who receive the gifts are Christians, whether they believe the gospel. Nonetheless, God is outrageous and lavish in his gifts to all people, and those gifts are good things in terms of art and culture and science. And so I find the answers to these initial questions in this Neo-Calvinist tradition through figures like Herman Bavinck, or Abraham Kuyper. And for me, it was life transforming as a young person, as a young teenage Christian, to discover that there is actually a rationale that explains how you live well within the world in quite an intentional way, and that's really all-encompassing.
Yeah, and I think the idea of common grace is incredibly attractive for me because, I grew up in Singapore and then I moved back to Jakarta before I went to LA and then Philadelphia and then Edinburgh. And what I realized just moving around these different contexts and also interacting with folks like my own family and marrying someone who used to be a Muslim and now she's a Christian and interacting with her family is this idea that really Christianity can take shape in any kind of culture, in any kind of specific context. And it's not the possession of any one culture. And it could actually look different in these different cultures. And that's actually okay, that diversity is not a threat to Christianity, but rather it's a strength of Christianity. The fact that each culture can be leavened by the Christian faith in a very particular way, and each come together in a more sort of richer way. That's an incredibly attractive vision from Neo-Calvinism, this idea of the Catholicity of the church. And what really attracted me to Neo-Calvinism and this idea of common grace and this idea of Christianity leavening every culture is how it spoke against my intuitions on common sense realism. I think initially, when I first started to study philosophy, common sense realism was something that was intuitive for me initially, but then looking back and interacting with Christians from all over the world, realizing that we have very differing intuitions about politics, about art, about culture, realizing that maybe I've got to revise these sort of intuitions. And Kuyper's idea of antithesis and common grace and the catholicity, the universality of Christianity, engaging these diverse cultures was really an antidote against common sense realism for me.
What's common sense realism, Gray?
Yeah, common sense realism is this idea. Well, we can go at it philosophically and we can go at it in a sort of layman's terms. I think basically this idea that universal intuitions are available to any person, and every single person has the same universal intuitions about morality, about nature, about ethics, and so on. That is accessible to anyone who just really thinks well enough about it, or to anyone. The pre-reflective intuition is universally binding on every person. And I think what the Neo-Calvinist tradition has said about that is that perhaps before the fall, that would have been the case. But after the fall, given the noetic effects of sin, our intuitions greatly differ. And also, given the sort of development of each culture going their own way, we can't take for granted that we all receive nature and natural law in exactly the same way. There's diversity in our intuitions, and we don't exactly know what redemption, consummation would bring to our intuitions. But the Neo-Calvinist tradition has always said it's not going to be uniform in exactly the same way. There's going to be unity across our shared redeemed consciousness, but there's going to be unity in diversity. There's going to be some slight differences, and those differences in language, culture, and even the way in which we approach ethics within the bounds of God's commandments is going to be a good that we share together rather than a threat to the expression of Christian faith.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, James talked about how he came to Neo-Calvinism through insights as a young person, as a kid, about the need for engaging culture. And Gray, you picked up on like coming at it through needing some philosophical explanation, interacting with philosophies that just didn't really make sense of the world for you. For me, it was different than both of those things. It was that I grew up in a Southern Baptist, you know, for lack of a better term, fundamentalist tradition, but went to a very robust Roman Catholic school my whole K through kindergarten through secondary school, all the way to the end. And for us, dinner time was always laying the Catholic idea next to the Southern Baptist theological idea I grew up in, and then comparing them, and then, you know, showing how the Southern Baptist one at the time would always win out. And so when I got to university and then seminary later on, I wasn't so much thinking about cultural engagement or anything like that. I was more looking for just robust theology. I mean, robust dogmatic theology that made sense of the Bible for me, but that also engaged with contemporary thinkers and things like that. And they assigned to us Bavinck, and I thought, I'd never read anything that engaged so well with the Roman Catholic sources of the day, with the contemporary philosophical sources of the day, with the Baptist sources, the Protestant sources of all sorts, whatever it might be. And so I was just thrown into thinking, I just want to read more of this particular author. And then it was from actually the theological dogmatic side, kind of the catechetical side, if you will, which I'd always been into in high school and things like that, that I started to realize that Bavinck was part of this bigger neo-Calvinist movement as one of the fathers that was that had a lot to do with things like common grace, cultural engagement, things like that. So,
yeah, so my story is maybe a little bit similar to James's, but the difference is that I grew up kind of within the Dutch new Calvinist tradition. So the church I grew up in was a direct, it was a kind of succeeded church, but still directly from the churches where Kuyper and Bavinck, who are generally considered the fathers of new Calvinism, their churches. So this was my tradition. But since I kind of grew up in the churches that maybe were a little bit like moving onward or forward or away from their history, these books were mostly gathering dust on shelves. So I went to Kampen as a seminary, the seminary where Bavinck also was a professor. But it wasn't really in view there. We didn't read Bavinck or Kuyper at all. I mean, they were mentioned maybe, and their pictures were there, but we had all this general feeling we had to move beyond this that was necessary. And so I needed international students or visitors to awaken interest in for my tradition. And it's kind of what I needed, because I felt I was in a church that didn't really have a tradition and was looking for looking for solid ground at some point. And at the same time also was in need of the thing that was introduced to me by these international people, and I think James was one of them, and when he came to the Netherlands, was this idea of common grace. Theological tools that would enable me to live a life not only in the church, that's where I grew up, only in the church kind of, but then tools to also engage in politics, in arts, and to just have theological ideas to appreciate and to value a life in all its broadness. So it's kind of ironic that I needed people from abroad to start reading those books again. And then I went to the Free University and took a class on Bavinck, and that really opened a whole world for me and made me enthusiastic about it. But still, it's really more, I sometimes feel that I have this conversation with you guys, people from across the ocean, and I barely can have this conversation with people here in the Netherlands. I mean, I'm exaggerating, but these books are still gathering dust on the shelves.
And I'm curious about.
Yeah. Oh, sorry, Greg, you go first. Yeah.
I'm curious about why that is, though, Marinus. And one of my gut sort of instincts about why that is because Neo-Calvinism has sort of forgotten that it has its roots in dogmatics, in theology, in a particular reception of the Reformed tradition, that it's not meant to be specifying something that is only about public philosophy or worldview or, you know, on politics and culture and things like that. These are sort of outworkings of a particular reception of the Reformed tradition. And I think one of the reasons why Neo-Calvinism has its influence, at least in the late 20th century, early 21st century, is kind of went downhill is because it's forgotten those theological roots. People have looked at the public implications of Neo-Calvinism, but in doing that and you know, nurturing a particular generation and just focusing on that, it's forgotten its actual catholicity within the Reformed tradition and its dogmatic roots in general and special revelation, covenant theology, and workings of these dogmatic tenets of antithesis, common grace, and so on, catholicity of the Christian church, and so on. But James, you were going to say something?
Yeah, so it ties in with that, the idea of catholicity, which for me was also a bit of an eye-opener when I really started to read through neo-Calvinist authors. So especially if you read Herman Bavinck, his concept of catholicity is very striking because it emphasizes not just the catholicity of the church at any, you know, like for all people who live in the same particular moment of time, but also through the ages and across cultures. And catholicity is also, like you were saying there, Gray, it's an ability for the faith to take root in any culture. So it's that it's the claim that Christianity is never just a local faith, although it does take a local form, but it's not a like a parochial faith, it's not an ethnic faith, and it's also not a faith that's tied to any one historical period. So when you start to read Neo-Calvinist authors, I mean, Bavinck and Kuyper both write about exactly this idea, there isn't a golden age in the past when the church reached its high point and that's when everything was great, and now we all just lament that, or that it's no longer the whatever the golden age was. But also it means that in how we live out our faith in the present, that we're not, maybe you could call it like a historical preservation society, or you know, you can go and visit tourist attractions where everyone still is kind of pretending that it's a couple of hundred years ago. The church doesn't need to be like that, because of a distinct kind of view of Catholicity, but also of history within Neo-Calvinism, which for me, I think was really attractive coming from a theologically conservative reformed background in Scotland, where there is a, for a lot of people, there's quite a big drive to look back to the era of the Puritans, for example, as the golden era. And in lots of what we say and do and think, and in the texts that we read, we're trying to continue that moment in some sense in our imagination, or in how the church, what the church looks like and what it sounds like. So Neo-Calvinism gives you a very different way to think in that regard that enables you to live sympathetically but critically within your own historical period, and gives you a different way to think about Catholicity that really challenges you to think and live Christianly in your own particular context. One other thing that drew me to Neo-Calvinism is, you know, we've talked a lot about different entry points that we have. So for me, as a young guy, it was the doctrine of common grace. But for me, moving towards Neo-Calvinism wasn't just that I already had everything kind of worked out, but there was a space to be filled, and this doctrine, you know, was borrowed from the Netherlands to fill that. But actually, the more that I got into reading Neo-Calvinist authors, the more I began to see that actually the shape of the whole thing is different in important ways, particularly if you compare it to very broadly conceived evangelicalism in the English-speaking world. So there's really great analysis of this in Mark Knoll's book, The Scandal of the Evangelical Mind. So that came out a few decades ago now, and it's primarily about North American evangelicalism, but you know, from a British perspective, it's really recognizable as well. So in his account of this, evangelicalism is based on the kind of common sense philosophy that Gray already mentioned, that you know, people are reasonable and their judgments are not clouded if you just teach them how to think properly. And so that's a kind of epistemological foundation. On top of that, you have 18th century Christians allowing Baconian empiricist methodology to move from the natural sciences, where empiricism is necessary, but allowing that to migrate into theology, and then giving theology a kind of Baconian way of thinking. So it's very much evidentialist, and you know, to do with it, if you just give people enough proof of the best evidence, then surely they'll be convinced. And then that gives evangelicalism a very heavily evidentialist character, and it addresses people with the good news as though it's blind to just how clouded human reasoning is by the effects of sin. And it treats us, or treats people, as though they're kind of blank slates who just need more evidence and better evidence. And there was a lot of that in the kind of British evangelicalism that I grew up in, evidentialist apologetics, and an approach to presenting the gospel that was very much, you know, if I can just give you 10 better reasons for why the resurrection definitely happened, or why the stone was rolled away, you will accept the gospel. And I don't think that works in the real world, because it doesn't correspond to the realities of like Christian anthropology, that humans are fallen, and that the noetic effects of sin on their reasoning are really significant. But then when you discover the Dutch Neo-Calvinist tradition, it's not based fundamentally on Anglophone epistemology, the Anglophone philosophical tradition. Instead, it has a different philosophical heritage that lies behind it. So it's more kind of Spinozan, or has a philosophical tradition that's much more aware of the reality of presuppositions. We all have a priori starting points in how we think, and you need that to be human. Nobody lives on the basis of only things that they've tested out empirically or anything like that. So the Dutch tradition is much more aware of our different starting points as humans, and that there's a kind of an arbitrariness about it, but you need that to live. It also accepts empiricist reasoning where that's appropriate, so within the natural sciences, but the neo-Calvinist tradition really resists empiricism being imported in a very artificial way into theology and therefore into the life of the church. And that means that that the gospel rings or can ring loud and clear, free of having to talk in an empiricist language that's just not its native tongue. And then I think that means that you find neo-Calvinist authors who can really unmask idolatry, who can show you yourself before God and theological reasoning in a way that, you know, if what you're used to is mainstream English-speaking evangelicalism, and then you see what can be done when you don't have all of those, the things that Noel describes, it's really a thing of beauty, and it gives you a very different picture of the faith that's for me was a huge upgrade coming from that kind of background of English speaking evangelicalism.
Yeah, thank you, James. It's interesting to hear that, because it's for me, it's what you just described feels kind of like the water I swim in, and it's just like is kind of the normal way of seeing things. But you have this experience of a maybe indeed a different philosophical system that gives you an entirely different view. I think it's also the part of this all still accounts for differences also between Dutch and Anglo-Saxon politics, for example, and ways of doing this. Although I have the feeling that things are changing also in the Netherlands, maybe in the direction of the more Anglo-Saxon model. But that's another conversation. I just wanted to play into the question Gray asked earlier about like the developments within Dutch Neo-Calvinism and how it is that it doesn't have any appeal anymore. And I think a part of it is right what you say, Gray, is that indeed theology got detached from other parts of the entire systems, if we should call it a system, or maybe also not only theology but also spirituality. I think that's really something for the church I grew up in, where we where all the emphasis was on the church, and then the practice of the church, like doing stuff and also doing politics and just being very active. Maybe the Martha and Mary way of following Jesus. It was really a Martha way, like using the broom instead of sitting quiet and praying. And so that's also really something I missed growing up. And I did find, kind of to my surprise, reading Herman Bavinck especially, but also Kuiper. But to come back to your question, I think so this is indeed part of the answer why it lost its appeal. So like from the right wing, in the Netherlands, you have people who view Neo-Calvinism as something cold and rationalist, which it isn't, I think, because James has just beautifully shown how it isn't, and I agree. But it can easily become that. It can become like a cold and rational system where you have to work and do, and where love and the heart and desire are just like become distant. So that's one part. And then I think from the other side was seen on the left side, so to speak, it was seen more as just too fundamentalist, as having a far too rigid view of scripture, for example. And so from those two perspectives, it just from two sides, it became like something just from the past, which wasn't helpful anymore.
Which is ironic, because like what James was saying and what we were trying to emphasize about the Catholicity that Neo-Calvinism really emphasizes is that it actually allows you to make account for differences, that it actually allows you to appreciate different cultures, that it actually takes you towards patience, I think, toward your neighbor, because even though they are different from you, If they're non-Christians, there's still common grace in them. And if they're Christians and they're culturally different from you, or you know, instinctively different from you, there's still the Catholicity of the Christian church. So one example of this, as I mentioned in my earlier sort of introduction to how I got into Neo-Calvinism, is I said, you know, ethics, there will be some unity, but there will be also some diversity. And I don't want listeners to kind of freak out about that, because, like, are you saying that ethics is relative, Gray? It's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that there is sort of unity in that every Christian can, you know, understand and recognize the good of the fifth commandment, honor your father and mother, for example, right? But this is one of the things that really helped me when I went to ministry back in Indonesia after I did my seminary and PhD years in America and Scotland. I didn't realize how Americanized and Westernized I had become. And for this commandment, the application of this commandment was really difficult for me. So honor your father and mother, I agree with that. But for example, when you get married in the West, you leave your father and mother. You know, you leave and cleave, people have told me, right? And that was intuitively, that held a strong grasp on me. So when I went to Jakarta, and honor your father and mother means that when you get married, you don't make a new family, but you extend your family. There's a very hierarchical and also sort of an extension of your sort of family empire by marrying. And the more your kids marry, the bigger your family becomes, not that you create new families, right? And the oldest in the family, the grandpa or the grandma is, or the great grandmother in some cases, you know, can still have the unilateral authority over the whole family, right? They meet this person once a month or once a week or something like that. That really challenged my intuitions. I'm like, whoa, you're like, you know, I would meet my congregants and they're like 45 and, you know, they're still like, oh, I don't know where to send my kids to school because my great grandmother or something told me that I can't be sent to that school. They have to be sent to this school or something like that because they have a family tie there or something. But I found myself very impatient with these sort of pastoral situations. But it was Neo-Calvinism that reminded me that, hey, these are Christians too. And they're applying this particular commandment this particular way. And it's already different than the sort of obviously Confucianist sort of families that aren't Christian, but they are still trying to follow this commandment, you know, honor your father and mother. And so because of my Neo-Calvinist intuitions, I can say I can't impose my Western intuitions on this because that would be a sort of renewed, you know, cultural imperialism, really. And at the same time, they are trying to wrestle with the fact that how can I love my family and extend this Christian principle of the sort of nuclear family to my situation without at the same time demonizing sort of this Christian but also very Asian instinct about how to honor your family. So anyway, that's just one way of, I think, Neo-Calvinism gets a bad rep about systematicness and stuff like that and rationalism, but really it actually fosters the sort of self-criticism and sort of cultural openness. Go ahead.
So, yeah, that's interesting. I want to ask y'all a question. Maybe James, you could start on this, but I talking about the diversity of the ways people think about Neo-Calvinism and how it's perhaps waned in the Netherlands and it's very alive in other parts of the Western world and also increasingly in Asia and other parts of the East. You know, when I talk to people who think about Neo-Calvinism, who have heard of Neo-Calvinism, where I'm contacted, and I know this happens to you guys, contacted by seminarians or whoever it might be that want to talk about this. For some, they think Neo-Calvinism and they think transformationalism. They think post-millennialism theology. For some, they think about mercy ministry. And for some, they think about vocation, as it's come up, or common grace, whatever it may be. And then, you know, Marinus, you talked about kind of that idea of the rationalistic way of talking about it that may be more present in the Netherlands, more associated with dogmatic texts that are a little bit too difficult to read at times. I feel like I'm asking an impossible question. Can we put a definition on Neo-Calvinism? Is that possible? And it, I guess let me ask a follow-up. Is it also possible to not only to put a definition on it, but also to make a distinction between Neo-Calvinism proper, maybe, and a Neo-Calvinist tradition that has a wider range of diversity, perhaps?
Yeah, that's a great set of questions, Corey. And it's a very, well, it's important to have some kind of working definition because the term gets used in a very elastic way, as you just said. It often gets used interchangeably with the term New Calvinism, NEW, which is a different thing again. That's a North American, mostly Baptistic movement within mainstream evangelicalism that has discovered a Calvinistic way of understanding and expressing what the gospel is, that we're sinners, that God elects, that the atonement has a particular scope and power and all that kind of stuff. But it's not New Calvinism, it's Neo. So the way that I try and understand it and also explain it to others is to try and begin with its historical starting point, because then that gives you something that's quite concrete, even if a century on it's become broader and a bit more challenging to describe. But the initial context is quite straightforward to describe. So we're talking about the Netherlands, we're talking about the late 19th century, and a group of Christians who wanted to use the historic Reformed faith to answer the questions of the modern age, the late modern age. So they were theologians who really believed in historic Reformed Orthodox theology, but who also had a kind of historical consciousness that meant that, well, we don't live in Calvin's Geneva anymore. It's not the 16th century. We don't support people being executed for anti-Trinitarianism. We've gone through two phases of industrialization. The Enlightenment has happened. It's a very different world. So you can't just keep on regurgitating 16th century theology. The times are changing. People associate that line with Bob Dylan, but Bavinck wrote it first, but in Latin, in the foreword to one of his books. The times are changing. So you need to be able to continue that older tradition, but recognizing that it changes and it drives forward through the ages. So it's an attempt to be Reformed or to be Calvinistic, but not being, I guess the logical pairing for Neo-Calvinism would be Paleo-Calvinism. So they're not Paleo-Calvinists, they're trying to do something new with it. They're also not radical doctrinal revisionists, so it's not that they keep the packaging, but then they fundamentally alter in a very deep way what the packaging contains. But they are nonetheless trying to move the theology forward, and very often that's a move forward by addition. So expanding the scope of the Reformed faith to address the questions of the modern age. So you have this really interesting movement in the Netherlands between the late 70s, 80s, 90s, into the beginning of the 20th century, where people are trying to reinvigorate a kind of modern Calvinism that's theologically orthodox, but that is also something that's native within the modern age. So then if you're talking about the original Neo-Calvinists, then you're talking about a group of people primarily centered on Herman Bavinck and Abraham Kuyper, and the ways that they think Calvinism takes shape in the modern age are quite focused on a lot of the issues that we've already discussed. The idea of plurality, the modern age is a place that incorporates and facilitates the growth of all kinds of diversities. How do you think about that? It engages a lot with questions around technology as well, because they're doing all of this around the context of the second industrial revolution. So technology is changing all kinds of things about what it means to experience life as a human being. Questions around art, culture, secularization, developments in the natural sciences in the modern age. So that all of these different things then receive quite specific focus. It also engages a lot with the question, or they engaged a lot with questions about the church in terms of late modern society. Should the church be established or recognized by the state? What's the church's relationship to and place within a secularizing Western world? So the original Neo-Calvinist survey focused on a lot of these things. But then, as you say, as it develops, their ideas are, I mean, they're remarkably comprehensive. You know, the more you read around Neo-Calvinist authors in this original context, the more astonishing it is just how broadly their vision could spread. I mean, it was as capacious as the world around them. And you have a couple of figures like Bavinck and Kuyper who are really polymaths, I think, in how I read them and their intuitions and also what their lives actually looked like. They did everything. and they've given the world a lot to engage with. So then it kind of spreads out over the coming the century that follows, which takes us up to the present day, where you have a lot of people who engage with some streams of their thought. And that gives it, that makes the question of, you know, who is a neo-Calvinist today a bit more difficult than asking who was a neo-Calvinist in Amsterdam in the year 1902. It's much more obvious then. Whereas nowadays you have neo-Calvinist influences that that you can see seeping into lots of different branches of theology and of the church a century later.
Yeah. It's also maybe a fun fact to know that the word neo-Calvinist was used quite early to refer to Kuyper and his people and his flock, and it was used in a negative way. But Kuyper quickly sensed that it was a word he could maybe turn in a positive direction, so he started using it as like a brand for his movement. But James, while you were at giving us a quick overview of that history, I was thinking of a fascinating example of how the new Calvinists took the old classical Reformed ideas and changed them. So there's only one time when the Reformed churches in the Netherlands that issued from Bavinck and Kuyper changed something in the confessions. So we have the Belgic Confession here in the Netherlands, which is less known, I think, outside of the Netherlands, but it's one of the most important confessions we have, stemming from the time of Calvin, from the 16th century. And Article 36 says something about the role of the government. And it's there's this one line, I do not know exactly what it reads, and certainly not in English, but it says something about the role of the government in opposing heresy. And so what happened is that the Reformed churches, the Synod took a decision to change this, to take out this one line from this Article 36 of the Confession, because they thought that in the time we live in now, the time we live in now, we should not say that the government has to oppose heresy, because one of the very important things Kuyper adhered to wasn't the idea of a pluralist nation, of a nation where you have different faith, where you have Catholics, where you have, in his view, in his time, the modernist liberals and reformed people and Jews, and that all those people should be able to live together in one government, and that the government should create a situation where those different faiths can live together, and they should, in the parliament, should discuss openly and freely what is the best way to go forward, but there should be an equal place for all those different religions and also different branches of Christianity. So they found that they had to, at this point, the modern times demanded a change of this particular line of the confession, and they boldly did so. They just took it out. And you now still have this difference, because the mainline Protestant church in the Netherlands has Article 36 with that line, while the Reformed churches hasn't. So that's just one example of,
So I was at a seminar here in Edinburgh a few years ago, and the speaker was from the Netherlands. And one of the figures that the speaker mentioned in passing was Abraham Kuyper. And the primary description was Abraham Kuyper was a theocrat. Because he said, so then you get the classic Kuyper quote that lots of people know, that there's no square inch in this whole world over which Christ does not say mine. And he was presented just very simply as a theocrat, and the kind of democratic aspect of neo-Calvinism is completely squashed.
That's the easiest way to know. Yeah, that's the easiest way to know that somebody hasn't read Kuyper, that's the one line they quote. Giveaway, they haven't read Kuyper.
Exactly, because it's exactly what he didn't want. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I mean, in the way both of you guys have talked about neo-Calvinism, I mean, I don't think the four of us actually have never explicitly discussed this, but I think about it in the same way I think, especially you, James, were describing, and that just, it's helpful to say maybe that there's a difference in something like historical neo-Calvinism proper and a tradition that flows from that, that often can equate neo-Calvinism with, for example, Reformation philosophy or something like that. And Reformation philosophy is not Neo-Calvinism, rather it is an outpouring or a possible path through the tradition that's applying what neo-Calvinism actually was originally, which was a theological, dogmatic, confessional movement of updating in modern times the work of Calvin and the Protestant reformers. And so it has numerous possibilities and implications, and can be applied in so many different places, different countries and cultures, and among ethnic people groups. So its opportunities are endless, but it really was a movement from about 1880 to 1920 and ended not too long after that, in the way I read it.
So let me ask each of you a question then, because of the four of us, only Marinus is actually a member of a church that you could style as a historically neo-Calvinist denomination, I guess, right? And for the rest of us, you know, we're Presbyterians, but they're not neo-Calvinist denominations. What is, and also none of us, you know, lived 100 years ago, so we're all 21st century people. What does it mean to be a neo-Calvinist today then? You know, Corey, you've just thrown out this distinction between historical neo-Calvinism proper and then whatever people are doing with the tradition today. So I have my own answer to this, but I'd really like to hear each of you first.
Can we just throw it right back to you, James?
Sure. I mean, I can lead. So I can lead in. So for me, I think it's not reductionistic to talk about neo-Calvinism as an identifiable set of instincts and intuitions about what it means to be a Reformed Christian, or a Christian in the tradition of the Protestant Reformation. And I draw this from Herman Bavinck's lectures on the, I think it's his lecture on the future of Calvinism, where he draws out a distinction between, in his terms, being Reformed and being a Calvinist. And for him, there's a way of being, you call it merely Reformed, which is that you think the Reformation extends to the Reformation of the Church, so that it's been drawn back to a more biblical way of being the Church than was the case in pre-Reformation medieval Catholicism. And it's the Reformation of our doctrine in terms of how to be saved, how to have your relationship with God restored in view of the problem of sin. So it's ecclesiology and it's soteriology. And, you know, other things that are Reformed within the Church, like, you know, that we reform our understanding of Scripture to make it the supreme authority in matters of life and faith. But it's a reformation that is an ecclesial reformation. Whereas Bavinck says that to be Calvinist is to be something different. It's to have everything that exists within the ecclesial reformation, but it also then wants to see that reformation extend into everything that surrounds the Church or the culture that the Church exists within. And then it's a discovery of the Catholicity of the faith, because it's a redemption of the Catholicity of culture. So for Bavinck, you know, if you're merely Reformed, your instincts are that you want Christianity to address and to change, to sanctify, to make new, to redeem your doctrine and your life within the Church, but it doesn't really have anything very direct or explicit to say beyond that. Whereas for Bavinck, if you're a Calvinist, it does. And you want to see all of life lived in an intentional way for the glory of God, not just within church or public worship or private devotions, but all of life. So it's much more capacious in character. So what Bavinck at that point calls Calvinist, because the neo-Calvinist label wasn't really a thing at that point when he said that. But that's the difference, I think, between neo-Calvinist and merely Reformed. And what you see in the way that Bavinck talks about other Reformed Christians that have the same kind of instinct is that, you know, he doesn't say these people are in my Dutch movement, they might have lived before then. I mean, he would talk about the Puritans as having the same kind of impulse to live all of life intentionally for the glory of God. And in a fallen world, that means that we have to apply the gospel quite specifically to each of these areas. And you have to be able to have a meaningful theological discussion about economics or about politics or about newspapers or about architecture or about food production or whatever, that the gospel is something that addresses every square inch of life, right? And then we get into quite Kuyperian ways to put this. So I think those kinds of instincts, there are lots of, so those instincts are very consonant with what we could call explicitly neo-Calvinist. And Bavinck has a kind of generosity of spirit towards people where he finds that kind of effort. But then he wants to draw them into the resources that his tradition provides to do that well.
Yeah, thanks. Well, I immediately have to think of just my almost daily work as a pastor in Amsterdam. I'm a pastor of a small Reformed church within a very, very secular city. And I often have to think, especially I think of the letters Bavinck wrote with his friend Snooker Groenje. I think it has been republished lately. No, what is the title? I don't know if you can.
So the Dutch title is Een Leidse Vriendschap.
Yeah,
Leiden Friendship. So it's just been republished in Dutch, and I have also translated it in English. So
yeah, I thought so.
That will come out at some point soon.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, so I remember reading those letters at some point, and I just couldn't. I picked up the book somewhere on a dusty shelf. And I started reading, and I just couldn't stop reading because it was so good. And I recognized myself in that conversation in Bavinck. And so just to explain, Bavinck had a lifelong friendship with someone he met at Leiden when he was a student there. And this man, Christian Snooker Groenje, he became a famous Arabist. He knew a lot about Arabic and Islamic culture. But he wasn't himself a Christian.
He converted to Islam to get entry into Mecca to go on the Hajj.
Yes, he even did that.
Take some of the first ever pictures of the Hajj from
Islam. Yeah, and he is still like considered an authority in this field even today. But they had a lifelong friendship, and they wrote letters. And in those letters, you see Bavinck wrestling with all those questions his friend asked him. And you see that Bavinck, already when he was a student in Leiden, really, really let those questions of modern culture come into his heart and touch him. And then you have this kind of wrestling in himself between his Reformed Orthodox upbringing, his heritage, which is not only something of the past, which still is in his heart, but there was also this desire to live today in modern culture, to engage with this culture, and to be able to have those conversations with his friend. And this is often how I feel as a pastor in Amsterdam. On the one hand, I'm in this church. I preach almost every week here, and so I take from Neo-Calvinism both that my tradition, my faith, my Reformed heritage is something that is really something I can maybe also they teach me to be bold a little bit in proclaiming that and living it, and also being proud and being explicit about what I believe and not hiding away, but that at the same time also really being able to listen to the culture where you're in and trying to understand what's going on, and also to appreciate. And that's where common grace comes in again. Only yesterday I was having a conversation with a woman who walked into this church, so she asked if she could rent this church building for like 2 days a week, and if she could, she told me what she did. She organized kind of a church without God. That's how she called it. So she organized spiritual meetings. She wanted to do singing. She wanted to start a community. She wanted to provide rituals for weddings and for birth and for funerals. So all the church, the things the church do. And at some point I felt that she was trying to take me on board with her and trying to say that really it all comes down to the same thing, what we all do. That's a good example of when I felt like, no. I have different beliefs, and I told her about some of the beliefs I had, which I could see in her eyes that really surprised and maybe scared her a little bit. But this conversation, and just to have this conversation, the willingness to have it, to learn from her, but at the same time remain rooted in your own Orthodox Reformed tradition. That's, I think, what it very practically means for me. It's just a tension where I want to be in. And I think that's a tension also Bavinck and Kuiper just dare to be in.
And I guess that comes a lot across in the tradition because they dealt both in the currency of common grace, which enables you to enter those conversations in a very substantial way, but also they dealt in the currency of antithesis as well. And that's a really interesting set of ideas to hold together. It gives it a really, it's a livable kind of paradox.
Yeah, yeah, I was going to ask about that because both of you are talking about this more holistic way of being reformed rather than merely ecclesial way. And that is a way of kind of saying, what does it mean to be neo-Calvinist today? How do you point out who is within this tradition and who's not? How do you guys think about the theological groundwork of that? You know, when I think about part of the neo-Calvinist movement, I ask, you know, what are the particular theological distinctives that drive someone to be instinctively neo-Calvinist in the way they live their life and the way they see life? And I mean, James, you've mentioned common grace several times. A few of y'all have. I mean, another one for me is the relationship between creation and recreation. But yeah, I think these are the kind of things we're going to have to talk a lot longer about on other podcast episodes. But yeah, Gray, what are your thoughts on it?
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And definitely neo-Calvinism has to be traceable back to these theological doctrines and instincts. And James, you already mentioned there the antithesis. And I think, you know, neo-Calvinism gets a very good rep from common grace. And everybody's kind of shy to talk about the antithesis because, oh, we don't want to be antithetical. We don't want to be, you know, fundamentalistic or something like that. But actually, I think that betrays a sort of misunderstanding of the antithesis. And actually, the antithesis helps us become more open in charity and more self-critical, precisely because neo-Calvinism, first of all, the antithesis is rooted in Reformed covenant theology, right? That we are either in Adam or in Christ, that in principle, this is really the division of humanity. There are those who are elect that are in Christ and those that are reprobate that are in Adam. So that's a Catholic, a Reformed Catholic idea that every confessional Reformed theologian would hold to. But also the neo-Calvinists make a distinction between the antithesis in principle, which is that covenantal idea that everyone's either in Adam or in Christ, and in practice, which is that actually, the antithesis cuts across every human heart, that not every single person, you know, everyone is still not yet fully redeemed and fully restored, right? Which means that the antithesis still, there's still residuals of our sinful tendencies in Adam, even within ourselves. And the antithesis and common grace really go together because the antithesis tells us every single person is still struggling with our residual sins and our residual sinful temptations and instincts in Adam. And then the antithesis cuts across every single culture. There isn't a culture that is more naturally attracted to Christ. There isn't a culture that is more naturally inclined towards special revelation and scriptural revelation, right? So it actually tells us that when you come and preach the gospel to any culture, expect elements of the antithesis still there in the culture. Expect the antithesis to reside in your heart. And also expect common grace to reside in every culture. Different parts of culture would emphasize different ideas that are echoed in special revelation. And so this is why the neo-Calvinists were being critiqued by both modernists and Orthodox people alike, because we're actually trying to say that we have to wrestle with the idea that there's elements of the antithesis even within the Orthodox. And so we're going to be critical of the Orthodox. But then there's also elements of common grace even within the modernists. So we have to also not only criticize the modernists, but also learn from the modernists. And how do we therefore embody this holism by embracing both antithesis and common grace is really important ideas.
Yeah, that's helpful, Gray. I mean, the antithesis, common grace, creation, recreation, and we could go on and on. There's so many distinctive ideas within the neo-Calvinist tradition that relate to the confessional Orthodox tradition, and how Kuiper, Bavinck, others and we are participating in the development of all that. I mean, I guess I just want to ask you guys, and for the sake of the listeners, what you hope to do with this podcast in light of all that. I mean, there's so much we've brought up that we have not talked about and can't actually get into. I mean, Gray gave a tiny snippet of antithesis and all that could possibly mean for theology and life. What are y'all's hopes? What do we hope to get into in the future?
So one thing that I would love to get into at some point, since we have Marinus on the podcast and I spent 3 years living in the Netherlands, is so Marinus mentioned, and we've talked about it a fair bit, that Neo-Calvinism can seem like a bit of a spent force in the culture that gave it birth. But actually, my intuition on that is to think about that slightly differently and talk about how actually it's not Dutch culture that gave birth to Neo-Calvinism. It's Neo-Calvinism that in very substantial ways gave birth to the Dutch culture that exists today.
Yeah.
And Dutch culture is profoundly marked by Neo-Calvinism in lots of ways that I think are quite remarkable and that make it unique. A lot of the best things about being Dutch today, I think, have a direct lineage to Neo-Calvinism, even if most Dutch people don't know that that's where the ideas are from. So I think that would be a really fascinating thing to flesh out, and with what the other liberal democracies can learn from the Netherlands in terms of how Neo-Calvinism has impacted Dutch culture, I think that would be a really fun conversation to have.
Yeah, and I think in some ways this conversation we've been having is kind of a table of contents for things we can address. James gives an example of the historical perspective. I think that's something it's probably going to come back more often. One of our guests, I think I can announce him now because he has agreed to be in this podcast, is George Haring. He's going to be either in the next or maybe after next episode. Who's a professor of the history of Neo-Calvinism in the Netherlands. That's definitely a part, but also I think is as Neo-Calvinists today, what we all are and want to be, is also the engagement with modern culture today. What can we learn? What challenges do we face? How does it critically look upon our faith? How can we from our faith look critically to things in culture?
Yeah, I think I'd love to tackle more misunderstandings of Neo-Calvinism, especially, you know, coming back to the States here. I really do see bizarre applications of the term Neo-Calvinism towards things like theonomy, theocracy, and even a sort of a newer sort of synthesis between American culture and Christianity. And also an application of Neo-Calvinism toward philosophy, and not really just identifying reformational philosophy as the only way of applying Neo-Calvinism. I can appreciate a lot of things that Dooyeweerd has to say, but there's other ways of thinking about it. And so we've got to talk about that.
Great, guys. This has been a lot of fun to talk together. A joy and a privilege. So thank you to everyone who has joined us as listeners. We'll be back soon with another episode. We hope you enjoy that too.